This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Capital in the 21st Century. Written by Thomas Piketty. Translated by Arthur Goldhammer. Narrated by L.J. Ganser. Graphs and charts found in the print version of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click on the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Introduction. Social distinctions can be based only on common utility. Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, Article 1, 1789. The distribution of wealth is one of today's most widely discussed and controversial issues. But what do we really know about its evolution over the long term? Do the dynamics of private capital accumulation inevitably lead to the concentration of wealth in ever fewer hands, as Karl Marx believed in the 19th century? Or do the balancing forces of growth, competition, and technological progress lead in later stages of development to reduced inequality and greater harmony among the classes, as Simon Kuznets thought in the 20th century? What do we really know about how wealth and income have evolved since the 18th century? And what lessons can we derive from that knowledge for the century now underway? These are the questions I attempt to answer in this book. Let me say at once that the answers contained herein are imperfect and incomplete, but they are based on much more extensive historical and comparative data than were available to previous researchers, data covering 3 centuries and more than 20 centuries, as well as on a new theoretical framework that affords a deeper understanding of the underlying mechanisms. Modern economic growth and the diffusion of knowledge have made it possible to avoid the Marxist apocalypse, but have not modified the deep structures of capital and inequality, or, in any case, not as much as one might have imagined in the optimistic decades following World War II. When the rate of return on capital exceeds the rate of growth of output and income, as it did in the 19th century, and seems quite likely to do again in the 21st, capitalism automatically generates arbitrary and unsustainable inequalities that radically undermine the meritocratic values on which democratic societies are based. There are nevertheless ways democracy can regain control over capitalism and ensure that the general interest takes precedence over private interests, while preserving economic openness and avoiding protectionist and nationalist reactions. The policy recommendations I propose later in the book tend in this direction. They are based on lessons derived from historical experience, of which what follows is essentially a narrative. A debate without data? Intellectual and political debate about the distribution of wealth has long been based on an abundance of prejudice and a paucity of fact. To be sure, it would be a mistake to underestimate the importance of the intuitive knowledge that everyone acquires about contemporary wealth and income levels, even in the absence of any theoretical framework or statistical analysis. Film and literature, 19th-century novels especially, are full of detailed information about the relative wealth and living standards of different social groups, and especially about the deep structure of inequality, the way it is justified, and its impact on individual lives. Indeed, the novels of Jane Austen and Honoré de Balzac paint striking portraits of the distribution of wealth in Britain and France between 1790 and 1830. Both novelists were intimately acquainted with the hierarchy of wealth in their respective societies. They grasped the hidden contours of wealth and its inevitable implications for the lives of men and women, including their marital strategies and personal hopes and disappointments. These and other novelists depicted the effects of inequality with a verisimilitude and evocative power that no statistical or theoretical analysis can match. Indeed, the distribution of wealth is too important an issue to be left to economists, sociologists, historians, and philosophers. It is of interest to everyone, and that is a good thing. The concrete physical reality of inequality is visible to the naked eye and naturally inspires sharp but contradictory political judgments. Peasant and noble, worker and factory owner, waiter and banker, Each has his or her own unique vantage point and sees important aspects of how other people live and what relations of power and domination exist between social groups. And these observations shape each person's judgment of what is and is not just. Hence, there will always be a fundamentally subjective and psychological dimension to inequality, which inevitably gives rise to political conflict that no purportedly scientific analysis can alleviate. Democracy will never be supplanted by a republic of experts, and that is a very good thing. Nevertheless, the distribution question also deserves to be studied in a systematic and methodical fashion. Without precisely defined sources, methods, and concepts, it is possible to see everything and its opposite. Some people believe that inequality is always increasing, and that the world is by definition always becoming more unjust. Others believe that inequality is naturally decreasing, or that harmony comes about automatically, and that in any case nothing should be done that might risk disturbing this happy equilibrium. Given this dialogue of the deaf, in which each camp justifies its own intellectual laziness by pointing to the laziness of the other, there is a role for research that is at least systematic and methodical, if not fully scientific. Expert analysis will never put an end to the violent political conflict that inequality inevitably instigates. Social scientific research is and always will be tentative and imperfect. It does not claim to transform economics, sociology, and history into exact sciences, but by patiently searching for facts and patterns, and calmly analyzing the economic, social, and political mechanisms that might explain them, it can inform democratic debate and focus attention on the right questions. It can help to redefine the terms of debate, unmask certain preconceived or fraudulent notions, and subject all positions to constant critical scrutiny. In my view, this is the role that intellectuals, including social scientists, should play as citizens, like any other, but with the good fortune to have more time than others to devote themselves to study, and even to be paid for it, a signal privilege. There is no escaping the fact, however, that social science research on the distribution of wealth was for a long time based on a relatively limited set of firmly established facts together with a wide variety of purely theoretical speculations. Before turning in greater detail to the sources I tried to assemble in preparation for writing this book, I want to give a quick historical overview of previous thinking about these issues. Malthus, Young, and the French Revolution. When classical political economy was born in England and France in the late 18th and early 19th century, the issue of distribution was already one of the key questions. Everyone realized that radical transformations were underway, precipitated by sustained demographic growth, a previously unknown phenomenon coupled with a rural exodus and the advent of the Industrial Revolution. How would these upheavals affect the distribution of wealth, the social structure, and the political equilibrium of European society? For Thomas Malthus, who in 1798 published his Essay on the Principle of Population, there could be no doubt. The primary threat was overpopulation. Although his sources were thin, he made the best he could of them. One particularly important influence was the travel diary published by Arthur Young, an English agronomist who traveled extensively in France, from Calais to the Pyrenees and from Brittany to Franche-Comté in 1787 to 1788, on the eve of the Revolution. Young wrote of the poverty of the French countryside. His vivid essay was by no means totally inaccurate. France at that time was by far the most populous country in Europe, and therefore an ideal place to observe. The kingdom could already boast of a population of 20 million in 1700, compared to only 8 million for Great Britain, and 5 million for England alone. The French population increased steadily throughout the 18th century, from the end of Louis XIV's reign to the demise of Louis XVI, and by 1780 was close to 30 million. There is every reason to believe that this unprecedentedly rapid population growth contributed to a stagnation of agricultural wages and an increase in land rents in the decades prior to the explosion of 1789. Although this demographic shift was not the sole cause of the French Revolution, it clearly contributed to the growing unpopularity of the aristocracy and the existing political regime. Nevertheless, Young's account, published in 1792, also bears the traces of nationalist prejudice and misleading comparison. The great agronomist found the inns in which he stayed thoroughly disagreeable and disliked the manners of the women who waited on him. Although many of his observations were banal and anecdotal, he believed he could derive universal consequences from them. He was mainly worried that the mass poverty he witnessed would lead to political upheaval. In particular, he was convinced that only the English political system, with separate houses of parliament for aristocrats and commoners and veto power for the nobility, could allow for harmonious and peaceful development led by responsible people. He was convinced that France was headed for ruin when it decided in 1789 to 1790 to allow both aristocrats and commoners to sit in a single legislative body. It is no exaggeration to say that his whole account was overdetermined by his fear of revolution in France. Whenever one speaks about the distribution of wealth, politics is never very far behind, and it is difficult for anyone to escape contemporary class prejudices and interests. When Reverend Malthus published his famous essay in 1798, he reached conclusions even more radical than Young's. Like his compatriot, he was very afraid of the new political ideas emanating from France, and to reassure himself that there would be no comparable upheaval in Great Britain, he argued that all welfare assistance to the poor must be halted at once, and that reproduction by the poor should be severely scrutinized lest the world succumb to overpopulation, leading to chaos and misery. It is impossible to understand Malthus's exaggeratedly somber predictions without recognizing the way fear gripped much of the European elite in the 1790s. Ricardo, the principle of scarcity. In retrospect, it is obviously easy to make fun of these prophecies of doom. It is important to realize, however, that the economic and social transformations of the late 18th and early 19th centuries were objectively quite impressive, not to say traumatic, for those who witnessed them. Indeed, most contemporary observers, and not only Malthus and Young, shared relatively dark or even apocalyptic views of the long-run evolution of the distribution of wealth and class structure of society. This was true in particular of David Ricardo and Karl Marx, who were surely the two most influential economists of the 19th century, and who both believed that a small social group, landowners for Ricardo, industrial capitalists for Marx, would inevitably claim a steadily increasing share of output and income. For Ricardo, who published his Principles of Political Economy and Taxation in 1817, the chief concern was the long-term evolution of land prices and land rents. Like Malthus, he had virtually no genuine statistics at his disposal. He nevertheless had intimate knowledge of the capitalism of his time. Born into a family of Jewish financiers with Portuguese roots, he also seems to have had fewer political prejudices than Malthus, Young, or Smith. He was influenced by the Malthusian model, but pushed the argument farther. He was above all interested in the following logical paradox. Once both population and output begin to grow steadily, land tends to become increasingly scarce relative to other goods. The law of supply and demand then implies that the price of land will rise continuously, as will the rents paid to landlords. The landlords will therefore claim a growing share of national income, as the share available to the rest of the population decreases, thus upsetting the social equilibrium. For Ricardo, the only logically and politically acceptable answer was to impose a steadily increasing tax on land rents. This somber prediction proved wrong. Land rents did remain high for an extended period, but in the end, the value of farmland inexorably declined relative to other forms of wealth as the share of agriculture and national income decreased. Writing in the 1810s, Ricardo had no way of anticipating the importance of technological progress or industrial growth in the years ahead. Like Malthus and Young, he could not imagine that humankind would ever be totally freed from the elementary imperative. His insight into the price of land is nevertheless interesting. The scarcity principle, on which he relied, meant that certain prices might rise to very high levels over many decades. This could well be enough to destabilize entire societies. The price system plays a key role in coordinating the activities of millions of individuals. Indeed, today, billions of individuals in the new global economy. The problem is that the price system knows neither limits nor morality. It would be a serious mistake to neglect the importance of the scarcity principle for understanding the global distribution of wealth in the 21st century. To convince oneself of this, it is enough to replace the price of farmland in Ricardo's model by the price of urban real estate in major world capitals, or, alternatively, by the price of oil. In both cases, if the trend over the period 1970 to 2010 is extrapolated to the period 2010 to 2050, or 2010 to 2100, the result is economic, social, and political disequilibria of considerable magnitude, not only between, but within countries. Disequilibria that inevitably call to mind the Ricardian apocalypse. To be sure, there exists in principle a quite simple economic mechanism that should restore equilibrium to the process, the mechanism of supply and demand. If the supply of any good is insufficient and its price is too high, then demand for that good should decrease, which should lead to a decline in its price. In other words, if real estate and oil prices rise, then people should move to the country, or take to traveling about by bicycle, or both. Never mind that such adjustments might be unpleasant or complicated, they might also take decades, during which landlords and oil well owners might well accumulate claims on the rest of the population so extensive that they could easily come to own everything that can be owned, including rural real estate and bicycles. Once and for all. As always, the worst is never certain to arrive. It is much too soon to warn readers that by 2050 they may be paying rent to the Emir of Qatar. I will consider the matter in due course, and my answer will be more nuanced, albeit only moderately reassuring. But it is important for now to understand that the interplay of supply and demand in no way rules out the possibility of a large and lasting divergence in the distribution of wealth linked to extreme changes in certain relative prices. This is the principal implication of Ricardo's scarcity principle. But nothing obliges us to roll the dice. Marx, the principle of infinite accumulation. By the time Marx published the first volume of Capital in 1867, exactly one half century after the publication of Ricardo's Principles, economic and social realities had changed profoundly. The question was no longer whether farmers could feed a growing population or land prices would rise sky high, but rather how to understand the dynamics of industrial capitalism now in full blossom. The most striking fact of the day was the misery of the industrial proletariat. Despite the growth of the economy, or perhaps in part because of it, and because, as well, of the vast rural exodus, owing to both population growth and increasing agricultural productivity, workers crowded into urban slums. The working day was long, and wages were very low. A new urban misery emerged, more visible, more shocking, and in some respects even more extreme than the rural misery of the old regime. Germinal, Oliver Twist, and Les Misérables did not spring from the imaginations of their authors, any more than did laws limiting child labor in factories to children older than 8, in France in 1841, or 10 in the mines, in Britain in 1842. Dr. Villermé's Tableau de l'état physique et moral des ouvriers employés dans les manufactures, published in France in 1840, leading to the passage of a timid new child labor law in 1841, described the same sordid reality as the condition of the working class in England, which Friedrich Engels published in 1845. In fact, all the historical data at our disposal today indicate that it was not until the second half, or even the final third, of the 19th century that a significant rise in the purchasing power of wages occurred. From the first to the sixth decade of the 19th century, workers' wages stagnated at very low levels, close or even inferior to the levels of the 18th and previous centuries. This long phase of wage stagnation, which we observe in Britain, as well as France, stands out all the more because economic growth was accelerating in this period. The capital's share of national income, industrial profits, land rents, and building rents, insofar as can be estimated with the imperfect sources available today, increased considerably in both countries in the first half of the 19th century. It would decrease slightly in the final decades of the 19th century as wages partly caught up with growth. The data we have assembled nevertheless reveal no structural decrease in inequality prior to World War I. What we see in the period 1870 to 1914 is at best a stabilization of inequality at an extremely high level, and in certain respects an endless inegalitarian spiral, marked in particular by increasing concentration of wealth. It is quite difficult to say where this trajectory would have led without the major economic and political shocks initiated by the war. With the aid of historical analysis and a little perspective, we can now see those shocks as the only forces since the Industrial Revolution powerful enough to reduce inequality. In any case, capital prospered in the 1840s, and industrial profits grew, while labor incomes stagnated. This was obvious to everyone, even though in those days aggregate national statistics did not yet exist. It was in this context that the first communist and socialist movements developed. The central argument was simple. What was the good of industrial development? What was the good of all the technological innovations, toil, and population movements if, after half a century of industrial growth, the condition of the masses was still just as miserable as before, and all lawmakers could do was prohibit factory labor by children under the age of 8? The bankruptcy of the existing economic and political system seemed obvious. People therefore wondered about its long-term evolution. What could one say about it? This was the task Marx set himself. In 1848, on the eve of the Spring of Nations, that is, the revolutions that broke out across Europe that spring, he published the Communist Manifesto, a short, hard-hitting text whose first chapter began with the famous words, "A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism." The text ended with the equally famous prediction of revolution. "The development of modern industry, therefore, cuts from under its feet the very foundation on which the bourgeoisie produces and appropriates products. What the bourgeoisie therefore produces, above all, are its own grave diggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable." Over the next two decades, Marx labored over the voluminous treatise that would justify this conclusion and propose the first scientific analysis of capitalism and its collapse. This work would remain unfinished. The first volume of Capital was published in 1867, but Marx died in 1883 without having completed the two subsequent volumes. His friend Engels published them posthumously after piecing together a text from the sometimes obscure fragments of manuscript Marx had left behind. Like Ricardo, Marx based his work on an analysis of the internal logical contradictions of the capitalist system. He therefore sought to distinguish himself from both bourgeois economists, who saw the market as a self-regulated system, that is, a system capable of achieving equilibrium on its own without major deviations, in accordance with Adam Smith's image of the invisible hand, and Jean-Baptiste Say's law that production creates its own demand, and utopian socialists and Proudhonians, who in Marx's view were content to denounce the misery of the working class without proposing a truly scientific analysis of the economic processes responsible for it. In short, Marx took the Ricardian model of the price of capital and the principle of scarcity as the basis of a more thorough analysis of the dynamics of capitalism in a world where capital was primarily industrial, machinery, plants, etc., rather than landed property. So that in principle, there was no limit to the amount of capital that could be accumulated. In fact, his principal conclusion was what one might call the principle of infinite accumulation. That is, the inexorable tendency for capital to accumulate and become concentrated in ever fewer hands, with no natural limit to the process. This is the basis of Marx's prediction of an apocalyptic end to capitalism. Either the rate of return on capital would steadily diminish, thereby killing the engine of accumulation and leading to violent conflict among capitalists, or capital's share of national income would increase indefinitely, which sooner or later would unite the workers in revolt. In either case, no stable socio-economic or political equilibrium was possible. Marx's dark prophecy came no closer to being realized than Ricardo's. In the last third of the 19th century, wages finally began to increase. The improvement in the purchasing power of workers spread everywhere, and this changed the situation radically. Even if extreme inequalities persisted, and in some respects continued to increase until World War I. The Communist Revolution did indeed take place, but in the most backward country in Europe, Russia, where the Industrial Revolution had scarcely begun, whereas the most advanced European countries explored other social democratic avenues, fortunately for their citizens. Like his predecessors, Marx totally neglected the possibility of durable technological progress and steadily increasing productivity, which is a force that can to some extent serve as a counterweight to the process of accumulation and concentration of private capital. He no doubt lacked the statistical data needed to refine his predictions. He probably suffered as well from having decided on his conclusions in 1848, before embarking on the research needed to justify them. Marx evidently wrote in great political fervor, which at times led him to issue hasty pronouncements from which it was difficult to escape. That is why economic theory needs to be rooted in historical sources that are as complete as possible, and in this respect, Marx did not exploit all the possibilities available to him. What is more, he devoted little thought to the question of how a society in which private capital had been totally abolished would be organized politically and economically, a complex issue if ever there was one, as shown by the tragic totalitarian experiments undertaken in states where private capital was abolished. Despite these limitations, Marx's analysis remains relevant in several respects. First, he began with an important question concerning the unprecedented concentration of wealth during the Industrial Revolution, and tried to answer it with the means at his disposal. Economists today would do well to take inspiration from his example. Even more important, the principle of infinite accumulation that Marx proposed contains a key insight, as valid for the study of the 21st century as it was for the 19th, and in some respects more worrisome than Ricardo's principle of scarcity. If the rates of population and productivity growth are relatively low, then accumulated wealth naturally takes on considerable importance, especially if it grows to extreme proportions and becomes socially destabilizing. In other words, low growth cannot adequately counterbalance the Marxist principle of infinite accumulation. The resulting equilibrium is not as apocalyptic as the one predicted by Marx, but is nevertheless quite disturbing. Accumulation ends at a finite level, but that level may be high enough to be destabilizing. In particular, the very high level of private wealth that has been attained since the 1980s and 1990s in the wealthy countries of Europe and in Japan, measured in years of national income, directly reflects the Marxian logic. From Marx to Kuznets, or Apocalypse to Fairy Tale. Turning from the 19th century analyses of Ricardo and Marx to the 20th century analyses of Simon Kuznets, we might say that economists' no doubt overly developed taste for apocalyptic predictions gave way to a similarly excessive fondness for fairy tales, or at any rate, happy endings. According to Kuznets' theory, income inequality would automatically decrease in advanced phases of capitalist development, regardless of economic policy choices or other differences between countries, until eventually it stabilized at an acceptable level. Proposed in 1955, this was really a theory of the magical post-war years referred to in France as the Trente Glorieuses, the 30 glorious years from 1945 to 1975. For Kuznets, it was enough to be patient, and before long, growth would benefit everyone. The philosophy of the moment was summed up in a single sentence: growth is a rising tide that lifts all boats. A similar optimism can also be seen in Robert Solow's 1956 analysis of the conditions necessary for an economy to achieve a balanced growth path, that is, a growth trajectory along which all variables, output, incomes, profits, wages, capital, asset prices, and so on, would progress at the same pace, so that every social group would benefit from growth to the same degree, with no major deviations from the norm. Kuznets' position was thus diametrically opposed to the Ricardian and Marxist idea of an inegalitarian spiral and antithetical to the apocalyptic predictions of the 19th century. In order to properly convey the considerable influence that Kuznets' theory enjoyed in the 1980s and 1990s, and to a certain extent still enjoys today, it is important to emphasize that it was the first theory of this sort to rely on a formidable statistical apparatus. It was not until the middle of the 20th century, in fact, that the first historical series of income distribution statistics became available with the publication in 1953 of Kuznets' monumental Shares of Upper Income Groups in Income and Savings. Kuznets' series dealt with only one country, the United States, over a period of 35 years, 1913 to 1948. It was nevertheless a major contribution, which drew on two sources of data totally unavailable to 19th century authors: U.S. federal income tax returns, which did not exist before the creation of the income tax in 1913, and Kuznets' own estimates of U.S. national income from a few years earlier. This was the very first attempt to measure social inequality on such an ambitious scale. It is important to realize that without these two complementary and indispensable data sets, it is simply impossible to measure inequality in the income distribution or to gauge its evolution over time. To be sure, the first attempts to estimate national income in Britain and France date back to the late 17th and early 18th century, and there would be many more such attempts over the course of the 19th century. But these were isolated estimates. It was not until the 20th century, in the years between the two world wars, that the first yearly series of national income data were developed by economists such as Kuznets and John W. Kendrick in the United States, Arthur Bowley and Colin Clark in Britain, and L. Duget de Bernonville in France. This type of data allows us to measure a country's total income. In order to gauge the share of high incomes in national income, we also need statements of income. Such information became available when many countries adopted a progressive income tax around the time of World War I, 1913 in the United States, 1914 in France, 1909 in Britain, 1922 in India, 1932 in Argentina. It is crucial to recognize that even where there is no income tax, there are still all sorts of statistics concerning whatever tax basis exists at a given point in time. For example, the distribution of the number of doors and windows by département in 19th century France, which is not without interest. But these data tell us nothing about incomes. What is more, before the requirement to declare one's income to the tax authorities was enacted in law, people were often unaware of the amount of their own income. The same is true of the corporate tax and wealth tax. Taxation is not only a way of requiring all citizens to contribute to the financing of public expenditures and projects, and to distribute the tax burden as fairly as possible. It is also useful for establishing classifications and promoting knowledge, as well as democratic transparency. In any event, the data that Kuznets collected allowed him to calculate the evolution of the share of each decile, as well as the upper centiles, of the income hierarchy in total U.S. national income. What did he find? He noted a sharp reduction in income inequality in the United States between 1913 and 1948. More specifically, at the beginning of this period, the upper decile of the income distribution, that is, the top 10% of U.S. earners, claimed 45 to 50% of annual national income. By the late 1940s, the share of the top decile had decreased to roughly 30 to 35% of national income. This decrease of nearly 10 percentage points was considerable. For example, it was equal to half the income of the poorest 50% of Americans. The reduction of inequality was clear and incontrovertible. This was news of considerable importance, and it had an enormous impact on economic debate in the post-war era in both universities and international organizations. Malthus, Ricardo, Marx, and many others had been talking about inequalities for decades without citing any sources whatsoever or any methods for comparing one era with another or deciding between competing hypotheses. Now, for the first time, objective data were available. Although the information was not perfect, it had the merit of existing. What is more, the work of compilation was extremely well documented. The weighty volume that Kuznets published in 1953 revealed his sources and methods in the most minute detail, so that every calculation could be reproduced. And besides that, Kuznets was the bearer of good news. Inequality was shrinking. The Kuznets curve. Good news in the midst of the Cold War. In fact, Kuznets himself was well aware that the compression of high U.S. incomes between 1913 and 1948 was largely accidental. It stemmed in large part from multiple shocks triggered by the Great Depression and World War II, and had little to do with any natural or automatic process. In his 1953 work, he analyzed his series in detail and warned readers not to make hasty generalizations. But in December 1954, at the Detroit meeting of the American Economic Association, of which he was president, he offered a far more optimistic interpretation of his results than he had given in 1953. It was this lecture, published in 1955, under the title Economic Growth and Income Inequality, that gave rise to the theory of the Kuznets Curve. According to this theory, inequality everywhere can be expected to follow a bell curve. In other words, it should first increase and then decrease over the course of industrialization and economic development. According to Kuznets, a first phase of naturally increasing inequality associated with the early stages of industrialization, which in the United States meant, broadly speaking, the 19th century, would be followed by a phase of sharply decreasing inequality, which in the United States allegedly began in the first half of the 20th century. Kuznets' 1955 paper is enlightening. After reminding readers of all the reasons for interpreting the data cautiously and noting the obvious importance of exogenous shocks in the recent reduction of inequality in the United States, Kuznets suggests, almost innocently in passing, that the internal logic of economic development might also yield the same result, quite apart from any policy intervention or external shock. The idea was that inequalities increase in the early phases of industrialization, because only a minority is prepared to benefit from the new wealth that industrialization brings. Later, in more advanced phases of development, inequality automatically decreases as a larger and larger fraction of the population partakes of the fruits of economic growth. The advanced phase of industrial development is supposed to have begun toward the end of the 19th or the beginning of the 20th century in the industrialized countries, and the reduction of inequality observed in the United States between 1913 and 1948 could therefore be portrayed as one instance of a more general phenomenon, which should theoretically reproduce itself everywhere, including underdeveloped countries then mired in post-colonial poverty. The data Kuznets had presented in his 1953 book suddenly became a powerful political weapon. He was well aware of the highly speculative nature of his theorizing. Nevertheless, by presenting such an optimistic theory in the context of a presidential address to the main professional association of U.S. economists, an audience that was inclined to believe and disseminate the good news delivered by their prestigious leader, he knew that he would yield considerable influence. Thus, the Kuznets curve was born. In order to make sure that everyone understood what was at stake, he took care to remind his listeners that the intent of his optimistic predictions was quite simply to maintain the underdeveloped countries within the orbit of the free world. In large part, then, the theory of the Kuznets curve was a product of the Cold War. To avoid any misunderstanding, let me say that Kuznets' work in establishing the first U.S. national accounts data and the first historical series of inequality measures was of the utmost importance. And it is clear from reading his books, as opposed to his papers, that he shared the true scientific ethic. In addition, the high growth rates observed in all the developed countries in the post-World War II period were a phenomenon of great significance, as was the still more significant fact that all social groups shared in the fruits of growth. It is quite understandable that the Trente Glorieuses fostered a certain degree of optimism, and that the apocalyptic predictions of the 19th century concerning the distribution of wealth forfeited some of their popularity. Nevertheless, the magical Kuznets curve theory was formulated in large part for the wrong reasons, and its empirical underpinnings were extremely fragile. The sharp reduction in income inequality that we observe in almost all the rich countries between 1914 and 1945 was due above all to the world wars and the violent economic and political shocks they entailed, especially for people with large fortunes. It had little to do with the tranquil process of intersectoral mobility described by Kuznets. Putting the distributional question back at the heart of economic analysis. The question is important, and not just for historical reasons. Since the 1970s, income inequality has increased significantly in the rich countries, especially the United States, where the concentration of income in the first decade of the 21st century regained, indeed slightly exceeded, the level attained in the second decade of the previous century. It is therefore crucial to understand clearly why and how inequality decreased in the interim. To be sure, the very rapid growth of poor and emerging countries, especially China, may well prove to be a potent force for reducing inequalities at the global level, just as the growth of the rich countries did during the period 1945 to 1975. But this process has generated deep anxiety in the emerging countries, and even deeper anxiety in the rich countries. Furthermore, the impressive disequilibria observed in recent decades in the financial, oil, and real estate markets have naturally aroused doubts as to the inevitability of the balanced growth path described by Solow and Kuznets, according to whom all key economic variables are supposed to move at the same pace. Will the world in 2050 or 2100 be owned by traders, top managers, and the super rich? Or will it belong to the oil-producing countries, or the Bank of China? Or perhaps it will be owned by the tax havens, in which many of these actors will have sought refuge. It would be absurd not to raise the question of who will own what, and simply to assume from the outset that growth is naturally balanced in the long run. In a way, we are in the same position at the beginning of the 21st century as our forebears were in the early 19th century. We are witnessing impressive changes in economies around the world, and it is very difficult to know how extensive they will turn out to be, or what the global distribution of wealth, both within and between countries, will look like several decades from now. The economists of the 19th century deserve immense credit for placing the distributional question at the heart of economic analysis and for seeking to study long-term trends. Their answers were not always satisfactory, but at least they were asking the right questions. There is no fundamental reason why we should believe that growth is automatically balanced. It is long since past the time when we should have put the question of inequality back at the center of economic analysis and begun asking questions first raised in the 19th century. For far too long, economists have neglected the distribution of wealth, partly because of Kuznets's optimistic conclusions and partly because of the profession's undue enthusiasm for simplistic mathematical models based on so-called representative agents. If the question of inequality is again to become central, we must begin by gathering as extensive as possible a set of historical data for the purpose of understanding past and present trends. For it is by patiently establishing facts and patterns, and then comparing different countries, that we can hope to identify the mechanisms at work and gain a clearer idea of the future. The sources used in this book. This book is based on sources of two main types, which together make it possible to study the historical dynamics of wealth distribution. Sources dealing with the inequality and distribution of income, and sources dealing with the distribution of wealth and the relation of wealth to income. To begin with income, in large part, my work has simply broadened the spatial and temporal limits of Kuznets's innovative and pioneering work on the evolution of income inequality in the United States between 1913 and 1948. In this way, I have been able to put Kuznets's findings, which are quite accurate, into a wider perspective, and thus radically challenge his optimistic view of the relation between economic development and the distribution of wealth. Oddly, no one has ever systematically pursued Kuznets's work, no doubt in part because the historical and statistical study of tax records falls into a sort of academic no-man's land, too historical for economists and too economistic for historians. That is a pity, because the dynamics of income inequality can only be studied in a long-run perspective, which is possible only if one makes use of tax records. I began by extending Kuznets's methods to France, and I published the results of that study in a book that appeared in 2001. I then joined forces with several colleagues, Anthony Atkinson and Emmanuel Saez, foremost among them, and with their help was able to expand the coverage to a much wider range of countries. Anthony Atkinson looked at Great Britain and a number of other countries, and together we edited two volumes that appeared in 2007 and 2010. In which we reported the results for some 20 countries throughout the world. Together with Emmanuel Saez, I extended Kuznets's series for the United States by half a century. Saez himself looked at a number of other key countries, such as Canada and Japan. Many other investigators contributed to this joint effort. In particular, Facundo Alvaredo studied Argentina, Spain, and Portugal. Fabien Dell looked at Germany and Switzerland, and Abhijit Banerjee and I investigated the Indian case. With the help of Nancy Chan, I was able to work on China, and so on. In each case, we tried to use the same types of sources, the same methods, and the same concepts. Deciles and centiles of high incomes were estimated from tax data based on stated incomes, corrected in various ways to ensure temporal and geographic homogeneity of data and concepts. National income and average income were derived from national accounts, which in some cases had to be fleshed out or extended. Broadly speaking, our data series begin in each country when an income tax was established, generally between 1910 and 1920, but in some countries, such as Japan and Germany, as early as the 1880s, and in other countries somewhat later. These series are regularly updated, and at this writing, extend to the early 2010s. Ultimately, the World Top Incomes Database, WTID, which is based on the joint work of some 30 researchers around the world, is the largest historical database available concerning the evolution of income inequality. It is the primary source of data for this book. The book's second most important source of data, on which I will actually draw first, concerns wealth, including both the distribution of wealth and its relation to income. Wealth also generates income, and is therefore important on the income study side of things as well. Indeed, income consists of two components: income from labor, wages, salaries, bonuses, earnings from non-wage labor, and other remunerations statutorily classified as labor-related, and income from capital, rent, dividends, interest, profits, capital gains, royalties, and other income derived from the mere fact of owning capital in the form of land, real estate, financial instruments, industrial equipment, etc., again, regardless of its precise legal classification. The WTID contains a great deal of information about the evolution of income from capital over the course of the 20th century. It is nevertheless essential to complete this information by looking at sources directly concerned with wealth. Here, I rely on three distinct types of historical data and methodology, each of which is complementary to the others. In the first place, just as income tax returns allow us to study changes in income inequality, estate tax returns enable us to study changes in the inequality of wealth. This approach was introduced by Robert Lampman in 1962 to study changes in the inequality of wealth in the United States from 1922 to 1956. Later, in 1978, Anthony Atkinson and Alan Harrison studied the British case from 1923 to 1972. These results were recently updated and extended to other countries, such as France and Sweden. Unfortunately, data are available for fewer countries than in the case of income inequality. In a few cases, however, estate tax data extend back much further in time, often to the beginning of the 19th century, because estate taxes predate income taxes. In particular, I have compiled data collected by the French government at various times, and together with Gilles Postelvinet and Jean-Laurent Rosenthal, have put together a huge collection of individual estate tax returns, with which it has been possible to establish homogeneous series of data on the concentration of wealth in France since the Revolution. This will allow us to see the shocks due to World War I in a much broader context than the series dealing with income inequality, which, unfortunately, date back only as far as 1910 or so. The work of Jesper Roine and Daniel Waldenström on Swedish historical sources is also instructive. The data on wealth and inheritance also enable us to study changes in the relative importance of inherited wealth and savings in the constitution of fortunes and the dynamics of wealth inequality. This work is fairly complete in the case of France, where the very rich historical sources offer a unique vantage point from which to observe changing inheritance patterns over the long run. To one degree or another, my colleagues and I have extended this work to other countries, especially Great Britain, Germany, Sweden, and the United States. These materials play a crucial role in this study, because the significance of inequalities of wealth differs depending on whether those inequalities derive from inherited wealth or savings. In this book, I focus not only on the level of inequality as such, but to an even greater extent on the structure of inequality, that is, on the origins of disparities in income and wealth between social groups, and on the various systems of economic, social, moral, and political justification that have been invoked to defend or condemn those disparities. Inequality is not necessarily bad in itself. The key question is to decide whether it is justified, whether there are reasons for it. Last but not least, we can also use data that allow us to measure the total stock of national wealth, including land, other real estate, and industrial and financial capital, over a very long period of time. We can measure this wealth for each country in terms of the number of years of national income required to amass it. This type of global study of the capital-income ratio has its limits. It is always preferable to analyze wealth inequality at the individual level as well, and to gauge the relative importance of inheritance and saving in capital formation. Nevertheless, the capital-income approach can give us an overview of the importance of capital to the society as a whole. Moreover, in some cases, especially Britain and France, it is possible to collect and compare estimates for different periods, and thus push the analysis back to the early 18th century, which allows us to view the Industrial Revolution in relation to the history of capital. For this, I will rely on historical data Gabriel Zucman and I recently collected. Broadly speaking, this research is merely an extension and generalization of Raymond Goldsmith's work on national balance sheets in the 1970s. Compared with previous works, one reason why this book stands out is that I have made an effort to collect as complete and consistent a set of historical sources as possible in order to study the dynamics of income and wealth distribution over the long run. To that end, I had two advantages over previous authors. First, this work benefits, naturally enough, from a longer historical perspective than its predecessors had. And some long-term changes did not emerge clearly until data for the 2000s became available, largely owing to the fact that certain shocks due to the world wars persisted for a very long time. Second, advances in computer technology have made it much easier to collect and process large amounts of historical data. Although I have no wish to exaggerate the role of technology in the history of ideas, the purely technical issues are worth a moment's reflection. Objectively speaking, it was far more difficult to deal with large volumes of historical data in Kuznets' time than it is today. This was true to a large extent as recently as the 1980s. In the 1970s, when Alice Hansen Jones collected U.S. estate inventories from the colonial era, and Adeline Domar worked on French estate records from the 19th century, they worked mainly by hand, using index cards. When we reread their remarkable work today, or look at François Siminade's work on the evolution of wages in the 19th century, or Ernest Labrousse's work on the history of prices and incomes in the 18th century, or Jean Bouvier and François Fouret's work on the variability of profits in the 19th century, it is clear that these scholars had to overcome major material difficulties in order to compile and process their data. In many cases, the technical difficulties absorbed much of their energy, taking precedence over analysis and interpretation, especially since the technical problems imposed strict limits on their ability to make international and temporal comparisons. It is much easier to study the history of the distribution of wealth today than in the past. This book is heavily indebted to recent improvements in the technology of research. The major results of this study. What are the major conclusions to which these novel historical sources have led me? The first is that one should be wary of any economic determinism in regard to inequalities of wealth and income. The history of the distribution of wealth has always been deeply political, and it cannot be reduced to purely economic mechanisms. In particular, the reduction of inequality that took place in most developed countries between 1910 and 1950 was above all a consequence of war and of policies adopted to cope with the shocks of war. Similarly, the resurgence of inequality after 1980 is due largely to the political shifts of the past several decades, especially in regard to taxation and finance. The history of inequality is shaped by the way economic, social, and political actors view what is just and what is not, as well as by the relative power of those actors and the collective choices that result. It is the joint product of all relevant actors combined. The second conclusion, which is the heart of the book, is that the dynamics of wealth distribution reveal powerful mechanisms pushing alternately toward convergence and divergence. Furthermore, there is no natural, spontaneous process to prevent destabilizing inegalitarian forces from prevailing permanently. Consider first the mechanisms pushing toward convergence, that is, toward reduction and compression of inequalities. The main forces for convergence are the diffusion of knowledge and investment in training and skills. The law of supply and demand, as well as the mobility of capital and labor, which is a variant of that law, may always tend toward convergence as well. But the influence of this economic law is less powerful than the diffusion of knowledge and skill, and is frequently ambiguous or contradictory in its implications. Knowledge and skill diffusion is the key to overall productivity growth, as well as the reduction of inequality both within and between countries. We see this at present in the advances made by a number of previously poor countries, led by China. These emergent economies are now in the process of catching up with the advanced ones. By adopting the modes of production of the rich countries and acquiring skills comparable to those found elsewhere, the less developed countries have leapt forward in productivity and increased their national incomes. The technological convergence process may be abetted by open borders for trade, but it is fundamentally a process of the diffusion and sharing of knowledge, the public good par excellence, rather than a market mechanism. From a strictly theoretical standpoint, other forces pushing toward greater equality might exist. One might, for example, assume that production technologies tend over time to require greater skills on the part of workers, so that labor's share of income will rise as capital's share falls. One might call this the rising human capital hypothesis. In other words, the progress of technological rationality is supposed to lead automatically to the triumph of human capital over financial capital and real estate. Capable managers over fat cat stockholders, and skill over nepotism. Inequalities would thus become more meritocratic and less static, though not necessarily smaller. Economic rationality would then in some sense automatically give rise to democratic rationality. Another optimistic belief, which is current at the moment, is the idea that class warfare will automatically give way, owing to the recent increase in life expectancy, to generational warfare, which is less divisive because everyone is first young and then old. Put differently, this inescapable biological fact is supposed to imply that the accumulation and distribution of wealth no longer presage an inevitable clash between dynasties of rentiers and dynasties owning nothing but their labor power. The governing logic is rather one of saving over the life cycle. People accumulate wealth when young in order to provide for their old age. Progress in medicine, together with improved living conditions, has therefore, it is argued, totally transformed the very essence of capital. Unfortunately, these two optimistic beliefs, the human capital hypothesis and the substitution of generational conflict for class warfare, are largely illusory. Transformations of this sort are both logically possible and to some extent real, but their influence is far less consequential than one might imagine. There is little evidence that labor's share in national income has increased significantly in a very long time. Non-human capital seems almost as indispensable in the 21st century as it was in the 18th or 19th, and there is no reason why it may not become even more so. Now, as in the past, moreover, inequalities of wealth exist primarily within age cohorts, and inherited wealth comes close to being as decisive at the beginning of the 21st century as it was in the age of Balzac's Père Goriot. Over a long period of time, the main force in favor of greater equality has been the diffusion of knowledge and skills. Forces of convergence, forces of divergence. The crucial fact is that no matter how potent a force the diffusion of knowledge and skills may be, especially in promoting convergence between countries, it can nevertheless be thwarted and overwhelmed by powerful forces pushing in the opposite direction, toward greater inequality. It is obvious that lack of adequate investment in training can exclude entire social groups from the benefits of economic growth. Growth can harm some groups while benefiting others. Witness the recent displacement of workers in the more advanced economies by workers in China. In short, the principal force for convergence, the diffusion of knowledge, is only partly natural and spontaneous. It also depends in large part on educational policies, access to training, and to the acquisition of appropriate skills and associated institutions. I will pay particular attention in this study to certain worrisome forces of divergence, particularly worrisome in that they can exist even in a world where there is adequate investment in skills and where all the conditions of market efficiency, as economists understand that term, appear to be satisfied. What are these forces of divergence? First, top earners can quickly separate themselves from the rest by a wide margin, although the problem to date remains relatively localized. More important, there is a set of forces of divergence associated with the process of accumulation and concentration of wealth when growth is weak and the return on capital is high. This second process is potentially more destabilizing than the first, and it no doubt represents the principal threat to an equal distribution of wealth over the long run. To cut straight to the heart of the matter, in PDF Figure 1.1 and PDF Figure 1.2, I show two basic patterns that I will try to explain in what follows. Each graph represents the importance of one of these divergent processes. Both graphs depict U-shaped curves, that is, a period of decreasing inequality followed by one of increasing inequality. One might assume that the realities the two graphs represent are similar. In fact, they are not. The phenomena underlying the various curves are quite different and involve distinct economic, social, and political processes. Furthermore, the curve in PDF Figure 1.1 represents income inequality in the United States, while the curves in PDF Figure 1.2 depict the capital-income ratio in several European countries. Japan, though not shown, is similar. It is not out of the question that the two forces of divergence will ultimately come together in the 21st century. This has already happened to some extent, and may yet become a global phenomenon, which could lead to levels of inequality never before seen, as well as to a radically new structure of inequality. Thus far, however, these striking patterns reflect two distinct underlying phenomena. The U.S. curve, shown in PDF Figure 1.1, indicates the share of the upper decile of the income hierarchy in U.S. national income from 1910 to 2010. It is nothing more than an extension of the historical series Kuznets established